I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks very much for joining me. This is Like It Is. Today we begin our Like It Is College series featuring West Valley College, located in Sarasota, California. My guest is Dr. Jennifer Taylor Mendoza, president of West Valley College.
So I'm interested, how did your journey start and how did you get to where you are now as the 13th president of West Valley College?
Yeah, I always start my story off really attributing my success and this kind of individuals who have shaped my worldview, associate them with my mother and my grandmother. My family is from the South, Mississippi, Memphis, Tennessee, Virginia, and they were part of the Great Migration out of the South. And Elizabeth Wilkerson talks about this in her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, when large population African Americans sort of migrated to other sort of states, metropolitan, you know, areas, New York, California. And my mother at 18 decided to change her circumstances. She was brilliant, you know, was accepted into the university and really was passionate around the field, in particular medicine and science, but did not love the conditions, of course, in the South. A lot of them being still the impact of, you know, Jim Crow laws, segregation, racism, whatnot. And so at 18, she literally jumped on the bus and moved to California and particularly landed in Inglewood, California. And that's sort of kind of where her journey began, but mine did as well, of course, some years later. And so just her sort of tenacity, her desire to seek different suns and to have a different life away from racism was really inspirational just for all of her children, but just her story and herself. And then, of course, my grandmother, who today is 93, and then my grandfather's 96. I have her own story. So I'll probably focus on my mom, but her strength to you know, give birth to 9 children and just endure the times in the South. She is just a phenomenal woman. But going back to my mother, though, that's where really my journey really began. And my mom actually attended California Community College. She attended El Camino College and received her associate's degree. And she was accepted into the nursing program. And she served as a registered nurse for Kaiser for over a decade. And so schooling was really, really important, as having a strong education for her children. I have 3 siblings, was crucial to my mother. I found myself in different type of school settings. She often felt that I needed an education, sometimes outside of the neighborhood schools. And so if I found myself in situations where I was the only, you know, African-American child and learning how to have agency and advocate for myself, but also kind of see the world through different lenses and cultures and languages as well. And so I contribute a lot of my ability to kind of lead and be independent, how I navigate the world, just to her. And so, you know, my claim to fame, and I know we'll get more into it, but my claim to fame is she really wanted me to be a physician. I was interested in ministry work. And so, but I still became a doctor because I have a PhD, but her love for education, her pursuit of a better life, her giving me the opportunities to experience different types of environments and neighborhoods and culture, I think really contributed to and led to kind of how I got in the presidency role. I mean, there's so much more in between, but I like to start the journey off with her. Of course, there were, you know, degrees in mentoring and coaching along the way, but I think her philosophy about education as the great equalizer and understanding it from a democratic sort of a democratic ideology standpoint, right, was really sort of influential in how I probably landed in education, in particular being a president, you know, her commitment, her democratic values and truth telling.
I am so happy that you started with the family, because the family is so, so very important in terms of nurturing us and giving us the inspiration and the encouragement that we need to have. And sometimes you don't get that in a book. You get that through the love and the nurturing in the family unit. No, your parents had a great influence on your mother,
But along the way, any professors, teachers, high school teachers, college professors, and so forth, who also encourage you to stay on the course and keep up the good fight, as they say?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's three individuals in particular, and I've had, you know, a few others. Yeah, for sure. I think the first person that comes to mind, one individual comes to mind was my first grade teacher, Mrs. Cook. She's amazing. She's a Jewish woman, and she's amazing. And this is when I was in a school in which I found myself being, you know, the only African-American child. And she was so loving and so caring and so supportive and so protective of me. And that's when I first learned about, wow, you can really care about other people's children. And I know there's a lot of research and literature on that, but she showed me so much care and support. It was as if she was my, you know, she thought I was her child. And it was great because she encouraged me to speak up. She encouraged me to sit in the front. She made sure that I had individuals to play with. And so she was instrumental. And I was with her from first to, it felt like first and second grade. I'm going to have to recall that. But it was just a wonderful moment. Another person I had was my fifth grade teacher, who also actually was Jewish. And she was really amazing. And I remember there was a time on the play yard where there was a young man who was actually being quite cruel to me and called me, I remember him saying something very just hurtful as an insult. And I remember when I told her what he had said and done, she was so upset. And so that was the first time where someone literally, you know, she kind of, back in those days, you know, the teachers kind of grabbed both hands, right? And they just kind of like, come over here, you come over here. It was a little different. You probably wouldn't do that now, but she just grabbed us both and she, you know, made him apologize. And so she stuck up for me and protected me. And she was, because I had came to her crying, I was actually hurt. She was like, why are you crying? What is going on over here? And she was so diplomatic usually and very measured and very calm. But when I had told her what he had done, she was furious. And so he must have got a lashing of his life. He don't think he ever had that before. So she was a respected, highly respected teacher. So of course she was okay. But that was the first time I was like, wow, what another example of, you know, how my mother can send me out into this world and actually, you know, someone else can care in that capacity. So that was another experience. Her name was Miss Wickwire. So she was amazing. And then someone who changed my life, and this goes back to higher ed, I found myself in the community college and was fine to attend a community college. My mother had wanted me to go straight to a university just because of just the kind of the resources and time she took to put me in a certain positions and opportunity. And yet I found myself at a community college, which was great for me because I was still going through a lot of just discovery. And so I just... But when I got there, I did really well the first semester. And then, you know, second year didn't go as well. And then I found myself not as focused and focusing on other things. So I got D's and F's and literally ended up on academic probation. So it's kind of interesting being at a community college where you find yourself on academic probation to the point that you get kicked out of the community college. So I was academically dismissed and I was told that I needed to go to another community college, complete a semester of courses, and then I'd be able to come back. And so that's exactly what I did. I attended another community college. I went to Los Angeles Southwest Community College, was able to pass some courses. And when I had gotten back, I had to go see a counselor. That was part of my plan to be kind of readmitted and come back. So I went back to El Camino in Torrance, California, and I saw this counselor. His name is Kenneth Key. And I wrote about him in the book, Minding the Obligation Gap. And when I went to go see him, you know, he looked at me and then he got up and shut the door and he was like, what's wrong with you? You look normal. What happened with these grades? And then, you know, I began to get emotional and it was the first time that really someone showed real, like he really cared. And someone in the sense of being an African-American male, because I had been raised by my mom, a single parent. So really not having an African-American male presence in my life. And he was so, I knew my father, but didn't have that support from an African-American male that I probably definitely should have had growing up. And he was so wonderful and supportive. And then from that day on, of course, I came back, I got back on track. Repeated courses, had to do what they call like academic renewal, and then got on my way. But not only did he help me choose the right classes, he also helped me with other aspects of my life, whether it was like driver's license or trying to figure out sort of kind of, you know, where I was going to live, things of that. He holistically helped with my all sort of needs. We call this kind of student needs or basic needs now. And so that was really, 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 really lovely. And from that moment on, I, you know, transferred to the university, got the bachelor's in like a year and a half. And then I got my master's degree in 2 years. And then I went on and got my PhD in 5 years. And so it was interesting that I ended up being at a community college 5 years, but then I was the youngest person in the PhD program at Claremont. And so one of the youngest. And so, you know, the world is kind of funny how our journeys just kind of occur and happen where you might feel like, oh, I'm behind. Then I ended up being the youngest. So yeah. So that's a little bit about individuals who are in my life that were quite influential.
I want to read just an excerpt from some of your marketing material that I have here. And I'm quoting here, President Taylor Mendoza leads for social justice and liberation, recognizing our shared responsibility to address the historical legacy of racism to create a more just system of access, reward, and long-term equitable outcomes to inspire individual achievement and generational impact. Then you mentioned the obligation gap. Talk about a bit about that, please.
Yeah, the obligation gap. So this is a book that it was a labor of love and a project just of inspiration when I got to partner with some dear colleagues that I today were still quite close. And it's just the obligation gap. So one day I, it's funny, I was at my previous institution where I worked. I was sort of in the hallway having a conversation at that time with one of the directors. And I had, we were starting a program that was for justice impacted youth. And I was bothered by some of the employees, faculty, and classified professionals that had just really kind of negative comments about helping populations of students who had been incarcerated or formerly incarcerated or currently incarcerated. And I was just really bothered just around the stigma and this sort of how they were just all the judgment. And I just felt it was just unfortunate. Here we are in a community colleges of second chances. And so I got off the meeting. I was like, and I said to this colleague who was a director, we are obligated, you know, to do right. We are obligated as a system to ensure that we have the support and we have the institutional structures and we break down those barriers. And we often, I said, we often talk about the achievement gap, you know, that sort of puts the onus on the students, or this opportunity gap that's still focused on the student to do something. But what about the obligation gap, the institutional obligation gap, the you know, the structures, the corporations? How do we break down those walls to ensure that folks who have been marginalized or disproportionately impacted are able to succeed? And so I said the obligation gap, and I've talked about and wrote about it. He was like, yeah, the obligation gap, we got to write a book. And then I was like, okay, I'm gonna, you know, walk down the hall. And then all of a sudden, you know, a year or something later, I'm writing a book about the obligation gap. And so the obligation gap is the responsibility of the institution, particularly the educational institutions, to ensure that they have the processes and practices, that they've done this sort of equity assessment, that the playing field is, you know, equity centered, right? And giving individuals what they need at the time. It's not sort of, you know, equality, but equity. I might be thirsty while someone else might be hungry and thirsty, right? And so how do we make sure that we're creating a system that allows for students to be successful? And what is our obligation to do so? What is our responsibility? So yeah, it's always nice to hear colleagues talk about the obligation gap and really embrace it.
West Valley College is designated as a Hispanic serving institution. I'd like to have you put your leadership administrative hat on and talk to our listeners about how you are navigating your college with the threat of loss of funding from the Department of Education and the really challenging aspect of students being able to express themselves in a way that may be deemed less than free for them to speak?
Yeah, this is a great question. I mean, gosh, especially right now where it's like, huh, you know, we're this time of political upheaval and, you know, and I'll just say it, kind of this fascist dogmatic ideology, you know, that's occupying the highest level of our national government, right? And really creating inhospitable habitats. And so, you know, HSI is just, you know, it's one way. I mean, being a Hispanic serving institution is it's an honor to know that we have a population of students who identify as Latina or Latinx, right? That they identify, but we know what being HSI, this when you receive money for grants, it just doesn't help one population, but it helps several populations. And so, you know, we do have a few programs, definitely. We still are going to apply to more NSF kind of HSI grants, hopefully. If they are here, one of the good news that we did receive is that the application process for HSI just went out. So that's still good news. But to your whole point, the fear and uncertainty about potential federal monies going away. And although we may not have a lot of grant funding right now, you know, we still aspire to have them. But just the idea that it could, you could not receive funding because of these populations is so harmful, right? And it seems so unjust. I guess that's the best way for me to say it. But at West Valley College, what remains constant is our commitment to democratic values, right? The importance of being measured, having civil debate and telling our truth and not swaying. So West Valley College has been crystal clear from the Board of Trustees to our chancellor that we are staying the course and that leadership matters. And out of these political times, we will stay committed and we will have a new reiteration of DEIA work. So all those who are seeking to really take funding away or dismantle programs, DEIA programs, for them, I am excited about the opportunity to have a reiteration of this work, right? And so I feel like, you know, our campus environment is a learning environment for students. And we're part of this unique habitat within the larger ecology of it. And I think from participatory governance to participatory democracy, you know, we do have the power to shape these experiences. So at West Valley College, generational change in our communities is still alive and well. You know, we're staying the course. You know, we're going to be strategic and mindful, but we have the resources to support our students and we're going to, you know, continue that. But it is sad. I think for myself, when I feel doubt or uncertainty, you know, I look to our students, I look to our past, I think about my ancestors, and I'm reminded to stand up and be counted for the democratic values that I espouse, right? And that's what's really, really important. How do we demonstrate human-centered behaviors? Because what's happening in the federal level is not human. It's, you know, it's dehumanizing. You know, it does, it's no, there's not empathy. It's not active listening. It's attacks. And I just feel that we have to, as leaders, stay visionary, you know, continue to inspire and to be influential, because we have the opportunity in these roles. And so, you know, it could weigh on the heart for sure, but it's important that I continue to create a hospitable campus habitat and one that is inclusive and supports all, right? And really, really conducive to success. So I guess to answer your question, we are navigating just fine. We have the resources to support our students, but I think it's just important for us to stand up and be heard and to have radical integrity when it comes to speaking the truth and not letting people forget history, you know, not letting folks say that, you know, 400 years of like slavery, you know, didn't have an impact, you know, or whatnot, or of injustices. So, and not try to forget. It's funny, we all have, it's interesting, our memory when it comes to conversations about discrimination, racism, and who's had the resources to be successful and what groups have not. So that's just a little bit of what I'm thinking about. But I'm interested in promoting unity and modeling radical integrity as an antidote to partisanship.
It's a certainly a traumatic time for faculty, staff, and in particular to students who, in some demographical groups, have been targeted. And I'm curious to know, how are you, through your leadership, getting that message to students that, as you just mentioned, that everything's going to be okay and that we got your back?
Oh, yes. Yes, we have so many kind of, and I'm trying to think of all that we're doing. But we're calling a few things, like Know Your Right. And so we have these Know Your Rights trainings for employees, so they know your rights, especially when it comes to ICE, right? And some things that we need to do, some things we don't. And that has come from the district level as well. We also have sort of Know Your Rights for students too. And sort of these, I forget what we're calling them, but they're basically sort of internal structures of where students can exercise or feel safe in an environment. I'm trying to, that is such a great question. I feel like I want to go back to it. I want to, but what we have done really is created structures internally to provide training, resources, making sure that students have their red cards, you know, making sure that we're, like, if Zoom is uncomfortable for students because they don't want to self-identify, that we have other measures in which students can confidentially, you know, speak to us, or so that we can give them the support that they need. So, yeah, we've just been kind of strategic. We have our director of student needs who has been able to really set up a strong sort of foundation to ensure their support and communication. One of the major things we've done is actually just communicate, right? So I've sent out messages to our entire student population. The Vice President of Student Affairs has as well. And, you know, it's just been really beneficial for us to kind of come together as a campus to really just help undocumented students in particular, whether it's through Undocu Advocate training, once again, communicating at every level, helping students know their rights. Oh, this is what it's called, Empowering Viking Voices. So we have Empowering Viking Voices workshops because we're the Vikings, that's our mascot. And so we've Undocu support group. So we've done just several things to really support, in particular, I'll say, undocumented students.
And we have about two more points here that I certainly want you to address. I'd like to have you provide some general overview of the Democracy Institute. I'll drill down on this topic more about the Democracy Institute in upcoming discussions on Like It Is, but I just give the listeners a general overview of the Democracy Institute at your college.
Yes, yes. The Democracy Institute, I'm so excited, at West Valley College. So the mission is to advance democracy through education and service. And it's so wonderful. Our purpose is to engage students in, you know, learning and, of course, having them participate in civic engagement at the local, state, and national level and international levels where it's appropriate, and promoting diversity, justice, equity, and speaking to issues that are relevant. And we have a badge kind of award system. So students who complete, there's three components. So you have coursework. So students are required to take sort of basic foundation coursework that talks about U.S. political economic systems and even social justice issues. And then the second component is kind of three-pronged, but the second component is like a speaker series. And the lecture series gives students the opportunity to hear like global, national, and local leaders. So like this week, the Democracy Summit, we're talking about sustainability. So they have to attend the speaker series. And then there's service learning, where students learn about just, through service learning, students can learn about just academic pursuits or as well as in life. And so these three components, coursework, speaker series, and service learning, when you complete all that, then you get a Democracy Institute badge. The program is amazing. It was started by two amazing faculty, Nicola Gutierrez and Janice Kay. And it was a labor of love, and they are just so passionate about what they do. And so it's been amazing to just kind of have intentional student learning, build really strategic partnerships across various disciplines. So it's very interdisciplinary, but it's just been amazing to come to an institution that has a democracy institute, where we're speaking about civic engagement and civic leadership and working with our local elected officials. And it's just awesome. So yes, that's a little bit about it.
I'm so happy that you started off the segment talking about family, and you listed three teachers who inspired you. Certainly talked about your mom, and my mom is near and dear to my heart as well. I was inspired by my third grade teacher about the importance of education. So I'd like to have you just talk to a student, regardless of his or her age, about the power of education. And how do you see the power of education lifting that individuals to the greatest heights available or possible?
This is such a great question. You know, education isn't just about textbooks or tests. It's about unlocking doors you didn't even know were there. No matter your age, your background, or where you start, education gives you the power to see yourself differently. Let's think about that. See yourself differently. To realize that your ideas, your story, and your potential matter. It's the key that can lift you from I can't to I did. It builds confidence, opens opportunities, and connects you to people who want to see you succeed, want to see you reach your full potential. When you're investing in learning, you invest in yourself, and that can take you to the greatest of heights. Because with education, every dream has a pathway, and every learner has a future waiting to rise.
My guest today has been Dr. Jennifer Taylor Mendoza. She's the 13th president of West Valley College. Dr. Taylor Mendoza, thank you so, so very much for spending some moments with me today.
Thank you.
The Like It Is College series resumes with part two of my session with Dr. Jennifer Taylor Mendoza, president of West Valley College. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.